Good evening and welcome. I'm Amna Nawaz.
And I'm Jeff Bennett. On the NewsHour tonight, the Federal Reserve Board raises interest rates again in the wake of multiple bank failures.
The political ramifications of former President Trump's legal troubles widen.
And doctors work to address the health care gap in rural parts of the country.
Some of the folks I see have never had health care ever, and they're in their 60s.
Never had health care, meaning they don't have a doctor.
Correct. Not only do they not have a doctor, they may not have had one as a kid growing up.
Good evening and welcome to the NewsHour. The Federal Reserve has raised interest rates again by another quarter of a percentage point. Today's decision came against the backdrop of troubles in the banking industry.
The rate hikes are being blamed by some for weakening banks, but Fed policymakers stuck to their stance that higher rates are essential for the moment to try bringing inflation under control.
After announcing the Fed's ninth rate hike over the last year, Chairman Jay Powell suggested the agency might slow or pause any future increases.
We believe that events in the banking system over the past 2 weeks are likely to result in tighter credit conditions for households and businesses, which would in turn affect economic outcomes. It is too soon to determine the extent of these effects, and therefore too soon to tell how monetary policy should respond.
The Fed has been doing its share of damage control and emergency assistance for nearly 2 weeks in the wake of the second largest bank failure in U.S. history, the collapse of Silicon Valley Bank, followed by Signature Bank. That sparked broader concern about the stability of America's small and mid-sized banks, like First Republic, where an exodus of customers fled to larger banks. Even before the bank failures, some economists and policymakers had been encouraging the Fed to stop interest rate hikes over fears of a recession. The Fed is also weighing whether additional rate hikes could destabilize other parts of the economy. At the same time, job growth remains strong and steady, with more than 300,000 new jobs created in February. Powell is facing fire from Republicans and Democrats on a number of fronts, including banking oversight, as it conducts its own review of the Silicon Valley Bank failure. Senators Rick Scott and Elizabeth Warren introduced a bipartisan bill that would replace the Fed's internal watchdog with an independent one appointed by the president. Warren called out the Fed on ABC's This Week on Sunday.
I'm calling for an independent investigation of the Fed and the whole regulatory system here. The Fed doesn't just get to do its own investigation.
Powell today spoke to that issue.
It's 100% certainty that there will be independent investigations. When a bank fails, there are investigations, and of course, we welcome that.
The Fed is also reconsidering rules for mid-sized banks around liquidity and stronger capital, something Warren and others say they strongly support.
Chairman Powell also repeatedly said today that he thought the banking system is, quote, sound and resilient. For a closer look at these decisions and the state of the economy, I'm joined by Kenneth Rogoff. He's an economics and public policy professor at Harvard University and the former chief economist at the International Monetary Fund. He's also the author of several books on financial crises. Ken, welcome back to the NewsHour. So let's just start with the news of the day. What do you make of the Fed's decision?
Well, I think they pretty much did the only thing they could. A couple of weeks ago, Jay Powell was warning everyone, I'm going to raise things 50 basis points. Well, after we're really in a start of possibly a banking crisis ongoing here, that's out the door. But I think he was worried that if he set it at zero, everybody would think, well, what do they know that we don't? And so he said, I'm going to keep pushing with inflation. But I think really they're very nervous of not knowing, is inflation going to go higher? Is the banking crisis going to get worse? It's a tough place to be in right now.
Would this have been different? Would we be having a different conversation today if we hadn't just seen the second largest bank failure in U.S. history and the entire banking industry wasn't on eggshells?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, inflation is still high. Whatever people thought it was going to go away, it isn't. There are lots of different measures of it, but it looks like it's going to last for quite a while. Even on the most relatively optimistic Fed forecasts, it's still well above their target at the end of the year. So they don't want that. The reason they don't want that is if they allow that to happen, interest rates might creep up to take that into account. And that's really what they want to nip in the bud. But we have this banking crisis.
So we've heard a lot over the last year about working towards a soft landing, right? Slowing the economy enough to curb demand, bring down inflation, but not so much as to spark a rise in unemployment. Do you see that soft landing as still possible?
Honestly, I think what they're going to do now is fly over the airport. And by that, I mean leave inflation higher for longer, whatever they're saying. I think that's what they're going to decide to do, because if they raise interest rates as much as they might need to, and they say they might, if we might get things worse in the banking sector. And I don't think they're ready for that, even though they were being told left and right that everything's really sound. By the way, deposits are fine. The real questions, are they going to be making loans in the same way? Is it going to be harder to get a mortgage, harder to get a car loan, harder to get a business loan? I think that's a real concern now.
Well, you say deposits are fine, but clearly people are nervous. We know those previous rate hikes helped to erode the value, right, of many of those bank assets, and banks' failures to prepare for that and manage around them partially led to some of those collapses. Should Americans be concerned about, right now, small and mid-sized banks, about their futures?
I feel like the Federal Reserve and the Treasury have kind of broadcast that they're going to protect depositors, even ones with billions of dollars. They bailed out with Silicon Valley Bank. I think they're going to continue that. That has a lot of problems, because bankers will do more risky things. It's going to lead to bigger problems in the future. But they've really telegraphed that. The problem is, the other side of the coin is that everyone's worried the banks will not be able to lend as much. The regulators are going to be looking harder. They're going to have to raise deposit rates, and they'll have less profits to lend out. So for the moment, it looks like they've contained the panic. But longer term, bankers do risky stuff, and they certainly aren't reining that in. And the more they regulate it, the harder it's going to be to get loans. So there are certainly problems ahead.
Ken, you did hear some of those concerns from lawmakers about the Fed's oversight ability. Given what we know, do you believe the Fed is up to the job of monitoring the banks as it's meant to be?
Well, yes and no. I mean, it's a very professional, great staff. But there are problems with the governance of the Fed. There's the center in Washington that everyone talks about, but they're the regional feds, which have their own world of governance. And typically the board of directors will have people from the financial sector. I was very concerned about that in 2008, and they even appointed someone from Goldman Sachs to run the New York Fed, the most important regional Fed. And I believe the CEO of Silicon Valley Bank was on the board of directors of the San Francisco Fed, regulating the Silicon Valley Bank. So that's been a problem. I don't know what the Fed has to say about that, but I feel like that ought to be addressed.
That is Kenneth Rogoff, economics professor at Harvard University, former chief economist at the IMF. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
In the day's other headlines, Russian missiles and exploding drones slammed into residential and other targets across Ukraine. Security camera video showed a missile striking an apartment building in the southern city of Zaporizhia. At least one person was killed. South of Kyiv, drone attacks damaged a high school and two dormitories, killing at least eight people. Police condemned the indiscriminate firing on non-military targets.
The attack began after 3 a.m. The reasoning is beyond explanation, because Russia attacks civilian objects without any warnings or conditions, and they don't care who is in the buildings. And now we see children and civilians suffering.
The attacks came as Chinese leader Xi Jinping left Moscow after meetings this week with Russian President Vladimir Putin. He appeared to make no progress on a peace plan for ending the Ukraine war. South Korea's military says North Korea test-fired multiple cruise missiles into the sea today. The North has stepped up weapons testing in recent days as South Korea and the U.S. hold joint military exercises. As part of those maneuvers, tanks conducted live-fire drills today, less than 20 miles from the demilitarized zone between the two Koreas. The exercises end tomorrow. Back in this country, the head of Norfolk Southern Railroad faced calls for tougher regulations after the fiery and toxic derailment in East Palestine, Ohio. At a Senate hearing, Alan Shaw voiced general support for new legislation, but Democrat Ed Markey and others pressed for specifics.
Mr. Shaw, will you commit to supporting legislation requiring at least two-person crews on all freight trains?
Senator, we'll commit to using research and technology to ensure the railroad operates safely.
Will you commit to a two-person crew on all trains?
Senator, we're a data-driven organization, and I'm not aware of any data that links crew size with safety.
Other witnesses said they're still waiting to hear whether the railroad will compensate them for damage to their property values. The FAA issued a safety alert to airlines and pilots today after several near collisions. Six serious runway incidents have occurred since January. The agency said it's urging airlines to review safety procedures and consider additional training. At least two people have died in the latest powerful storm to batter California. Heavy rain and fierce winds blasted the San Francisco Bay Area and Sacramento on Tuesday. Drone video showed extensive flood damage in the central part of the state, with homes, roads, and farmland left underwater. Forecasters warned of more flooding today. And on Wall Street, stocks fell after the Federal Reserve hiked interest rates, with major indices down 1.6%. The Dow Jones Industrial Average lost 530 points to close at 32,030. The NASDAQ slipped 190 points. The S&P 500 dropped 66. Still to come on the NewsHour, the government announces plans to overhaul the organ transplant system. The U.S. Supreme Court hears a trademark case involving whiskey and dog toys. We'll explain. And the head of the Ford Foundation on his new book about changing the way we think about giving.
This is the PBS NewsHour from WETA Studios in Washington and in the West from the Walter Cronkite School of Journalism at Arizona State University.
The Manhattan grand jury hearing evidence in a case involving former President Donald Trump's alleged hush money payments to an adult film actress didn't meet today as regularly scheduled, with no immediate word on why, leaving open the question of whether Mr. Trump will be indicted. Meantime, the former president is said to be invigorated by the possibility of an indictment. The New York Times reports that he's told his friends he welcomes the idea of being paraded by the authorities before a throng of reporters and news cameras, all of it raising questions not just about his fate, but that of the Republican Party, which has largely tied its future to Donald Trump's. Republican strategist Doug High is a former communications director to House Majority Leader Eric Cantor and the RNC, and he joins us now. Thanks for being here.
It's good to be with you.
So Donald Trump has successfully fundraised off of what he says is an expected indictment. What do you make of this notion that he would use a potential arrest, a potential indictment, as part of a campaign strategy to galvanize his supporters?
Donald Trump very skillfully uses anything to his advantage, even if sometimes we have to scratch our head and say, why would that be to Donald Trump's advantage? The rules have never really applied to him that they would with any other candidate. And certainly in this case, in the short term, meaning the primary calendar, this is something that he'll be able to use to help galvanize support, because it's entirely consistent with what his opening message was when he took that escalator ride down in his own building in New York, that the system is rigged, it's rigged against you, it's rigged against me. So he's consistent here, and that's why it helps him short term. Long term, if he's the general, if he's the nominee in the general election, disaster.
Meantime, President Trump's allies in the House, to include a trio of committee leaders, have used their new majority to demand the testimony of the Manhattan DA, Alvin Bragg. It reads to many people like an extraordinary effort to influence an ongoing grand jury deliberation investigation. This topic has also consumed much of the GOP's retreat in Florida this past week, with House Speaker Kevin McCarthy talking to reporters.
I look at it from this perspective. We live in America and it should be equal justice. This was personal money. This wasn't trying to hide. This was 7 years ago, statute of limitation. And I think in your heart of hearts, you know too, that you think this is just political. And I think that's what the rest of the country thinks. And we're kind of tired of that.
Is that the smart political move? And I ask the question because it's not just the Manhattan case that he faces in terms of legal and criminal exposure. It's also the case in Georgia, yeah. Another New York case, and the two federal investigations.
Well, as you shown, there's a lot going on here, and a lot of things can be true at once. It can be true that what's happening in Manhattan is political, and that Donald Trump might have just committed a crime somewhere. And the challenge, I think, for Republicans here is, and we've seen this for years now, if you want to play Donald Trump's game, you've always got to back him up. And the problem there is Donald Trump is not somebody who gives points. He only takes them away one at a time. So you have to back him in Manhattan. You're going to have to back him in Georgia. And one of these places, he might have just done something wrong, which means he'll be indicted and then potentially found guilty. And so this is where Republicans have backed themselves in a corner. And that's not going to change anytime soon. It's been a long time as the party's history already.
Well, after months of waving off taunts from Donald Trump, Florida Governor Ron DeSantis is starting to hit back. He took some shots at an interview that's expected to air tomorrow at Donald Trump's character and his leadership. And earlier this week, he spoke about this hush money case.
I don't know what goes into paying hush money to a porn star to secure silence over some type of alleged affair. I can't speak to that. But what I can speak to is that if you have a prosecutor who is ignoring crimes happening every single day in his jurisdiction, and he chooses to go back many, many years ago to try to use something about porn star hush money payments, you know, that's an example of pursuing a political agenda and weaponizing the office.
Governor DeSantis knew what he was doing there with that statement. I mean, is there room for criticism of Donald Trump now in the Republican Party? Have the political winds shifted?
What we're seeing is there's some room, depending on how you do it, where you can go after Trump on Trumpy things. A lot of Republicans have been critical on Trump on specific policy things. Marco Rubio, very tough on the Trump administration on China. Lindsey Graham, often very difficult and tough on Donald Trump on a Tuesday or Wednesday, might be playing golf with him on Saturday. But DeSantis obviously is in a different position. He's potentially running against Trump. Everybody thinks that he will. And this isn't exactly taking the gloves off yet. The gloves are still on. So these are soft blows that he's throwing at Trump. Ultimately, he can do this for a while. He can't do it in perpetuity. But he's smart, DeSantis is, and strategic in taking on Trump a little bit at a time, but also not taking Donald Trump's bait. Because what is he ultimately doing there? He's taking Trump's line as well, that this system's rigged, it's unfair. And part of what you're hearing, you heard from Kevin McCarthy, you heard from DeSantis, is very Clinton-esque. When we had the Bill Clinton impeachment scandal, a lot of the Democratic rhetoric was, this is old news, we need to move on. That's what a lot of Republicans are saying right now, too.
Well, on that point, I mean, if you think about what happened in the 2020 election, in the 2018 midterms, in the 2022 midterms, independent suburban voters who are inclined to vote for Republicans don't like Donald Trump. That was clear at the ballot box. Republicans paid a price for that. Looking ahead, I mean, at what point do Republicans break from the tried and true deep red base, the demands and the desires of that base, to attract a wider base of support?
Well, the challenge is it's not up to the Republican Party, however you define that. When I worked at the RNC in 2010, we had a great cycle that year, but we also knew you don't really win or lose races in Washington. You win and lose them in congressional districts and in states. And the problem Republicans have is just look at some of the candidates they've nominated, not just in 2022, but we can go back to 2010, 2012, 2014. A lot of these elections where very winnable races were essentially thrown away because Republicans nominated the wrong candidate. And that's really difficult, whether you're the NRCC, the NRSC, or the RNC. The RNC doesn't get involved in primaries as a rule. NRCC and NRSC, they're starting to flex their muscles a little bit more than we've seen in the past because they know that mistake. And this ultimately is what Mitch McConnell has warned the party. We need quality candidates. If we don't have that, Trump or no Trump, Republicans are going to have the same problems they've had and disappointing elections as we did in 2022.
Doug High, thanks for coming in. Appreciate your insights.
The Biden administration announced plans today to overhaul the network that's run the nation's organ transplant system for nearly four decades. The United Network for Organ Sharing, known as UNOS, has faced criticism for inadequately managing the process. In 2022, doctors performed more than 42,000 transplants in the U.S., but there are still 104,234 men, women, and children currently on the organ transplant wait list. And every 10 minutes, another person is added to that list. 17 people die every day waiting for an organ transplant. The proposal would open up a competitive bidding process for other organizations to possibly take over the network with the goal of shortening wait times and saving lives. To help us understand why this overhaul is crucial, I'm joined by Dr. Jamie Locke, director of the Division of Transplantation at the Hirsing School of Medicine for the University of Alabama in Birmingham. Dr. Locke, welcome and thanks for joining us. There's a lot the administration's plan seeks to do. At the heart of it, though, is breaking up this network that's basically operated like a monopoly for almost 40 years. Help us understand, how did it come to be that way in the first place?
Yeah, thank you so much. I think in many ways it's been that way because sort of there's been a lot of inertia to overcome. In part, it reflects how the National Organ Transplant Act was written. And sort of some of the requirements that HRSA has in terms of administering that contract. But it's great to see a desire to reflect on where we are and how we can get a lot better so that we can help our patients.
So that UNOS system relies basically on a network of more than 50 local organizations to both procure the organs and also help to manage the transplant process. And we should note that network is responsible for increasing the number of transplants performed over the years. But critics say that system has led to vast regional inequities. Where have you seen that shown up?
Well, I think for us in particular in the southeastern United States, particularly when you look at things like kidney disease, there's no question that recently we've seen an increase in the number of transplants, but that really reflects, sadly, an opioid crisis that's really increased the number of deceased donors as a result of that. But what those numbers don't reflect is the increase in discards that we've seen as a result of some of the new allocation systems. And currently, due to inefficiencies with our allocation systems as well as logistics, one in four kidneys are actually discarded in the United States or not transplanted. That's one in four. That's 25%. And those are really lives that could have been saved if we could have utilized those organs.
There is the issue of the wait list as well. And we should note there have been previous attempts to fix the system. HHS back in 2021 pointed out that Black people were four times more likely and Latinos were almost one and a half times more likely than white people to have kidney failure, but are less likely to be on those transplant wait lists and less likely to have transplants. Why is that? Why is it so hard to even get on the wait list in the first place?
It's a great question. Well, quite frankly, simply put, you have to have resources to be able to complete your evaluation and your workup to make it to the waiting list. So if you look, there are about 700,000 Americans that have kidney failure. Fewer than 100,000 are currently waitlisted for transplant. So we know not all patients who would benefit from transplant ever make it to the waiting list. And that certainly disproportionately impacts people who self-identify as African American or Black. And certainly social determinants of health drive a large proportion of this. So you see individuals who are from areas of high social vulnerability struggle to a much larger extent to make it to the waiting list and to achieve transplant.
Dr. Locke, you're on the front lines of this every day. I have to ask, when you look at this plan, do you believe a competitive process, the proposal as they've put it forward, that this can help to fix the system?
I think it certainly can, and it certainly can't hurt. You know, there's nothing worse than going to clinic and evaluating patients and knowing that even those patients who qualify for waitlisting, many of them are going to die before we ever have an opportunity to offer them a transplant. And we know that transplants are life-saving, life-giving. They are associated with a substantial survival benefit. And what is just so disheartening is to know that in many cases, organs are being discarded simply from logistical challenges, from not getting the organs where they need to go fast enough. You know, organs have a shelf life. They can only be out of the body for so long. They can only be on ice for so long before they're no longer good enough to transplant. So no matter how good an OPO is at finding an organ or how good a transplant center is at accepting those and doing the transplant, if they don't get where they're needed quickly enough, then the game's over. And so I think anything that can help our system get better, to be more efficient so that we can help those individuals waiting, that's a win.
Meanwhile, as we mentioned, there are more than 100,000 people currently on that wait list. What does this proposal mean for them?
Well, my hope is that it means that they have a new, renewed hope for the opportunity to achieve the gift of life in the form of a transplant. My hope is that it gives them a voice. You know, I think this is the Biden administration, along with the Senate and the House, which has had bipartisan support, saying we need to do better. We need to do more for these individuals who have been waiting, and to let them know that they're not forgotten and that we need to do better collectively to help them achieve this extraordinary gift of life.
That is Dr. Jamie Locke joining us from the University of Alabama at Birmingham. Thank you for your time, doctor.
Thank you.
When it comes to health, rural America lags far behind the rest of the country. The reasons are complex, from demographics to doctor shortages to the sheer distances that many people have to travel to see a provider. These challenges are the focus of a series we start tonight, with support from the Pulitzer Center and in collaboration with the Global Health Reporting Center. William Brangham reports from West Virginia for our series, Rural RX.
And this is where I grew up. I've lived in Morgan County my entire life. We're up here in a mountain. You're an hour from your nearest Walmart. So some people may not want to live that way, but to us, this is home.
This mountain, this slice of West Virginia, has been home to Nurse Angie Gray's family for six generations.
Hey, Erin. Hi, Patty.
Hi.
Gray is visiting a family friend, Patty, who has chronic obstructive pulmonary disease. She struggles to afford her medications and cannot live without her oxygen. The power at their house is unreliable, so there's a generator at the ready so Patty can always breathe.
It's hard finding someone good around this area to help you.
Gray says these kinds of struggles are everywhere here.
So that might be an option that can help. We take care of our own. I always say that West Virginians are all connected. You know, we're all family. But really my mission is to advocate for people who are so vulnerable that they don't have a voice. When you look at West Virginia specifically, we have the highest numbers of chronic disease, diabetes, heart disease. We're losing so many of our people to death and early to death.
On nearly every health metric, rural America fares worse than the rest of the country, from life expectancy to maternal mortality. Compared to urban areas, rural residents are a third more likely to die of diabetes, about 20% more likely to die from heart disease, and more likely to die of cancer or accidents. There are higher smoking rates here and fewer people with health insurance. In many health categories, West Virginia, a heavily rural state, ranks dead last. These are the challenges that Dr. Michael Laudner and his colleagues face. He's chairman of the emergency department at Berkeley Medical Center in Martinsburg.
For as many of the myths, or some of those myths are not urban legends, they're reality. The idea that someone waited 4 days having a heart attack at home because they couldn't get transportation, and they wouldn't call 911 because it costs too much, even though it's free in most of the regions, but they don't know that.
People in rural areas are less likely to have access to good quality health care. Compared to urban areas, rural America has fewer nurses and fewer than half as many doctors per person. People have to go farther to access care, unless they have someone like Angie Gray to help them.
So if you already struggle for transportation, or you live in a more rural area that's going to take you an hour to access health care, some places in West Virginia 2 hours to access health care, you know, you're less likely to make it there and to get help.
When people do come for care, they're often using the emergency room as a doctor's office, something Dr. Laudner and his team have turned into a virtue.
For a lot of those folks, we can actually use our emergency department sort of as a primary care office sometimes. And so a number of those people were here with kids with fevers. So we're giving them antipyretics and we're doing swabs. Why do you need to be in a room doing that? And on any given day, you have 3 rooms with 8-year-olds that have flu, 2 overdoses, and then 5 people who are elderly and looking for admission because they're chronic diseases.
In some cases, he says, that emergency room visit is the first time a patient has seen a doctor in their entire life.
Some of the folks I see have never had healthcare ever, and they're in their 60s
or 70s. Never had healthcare, meaning they don't have a doctor.
Correct. Not only do they not have a doctor, they may not have had one as a kid growing up. They may have never been vaccinated. For them, the opportunity might just to meet a physician for the first time. Or they come in and you say, do you have any history of high blood pressure, diabetes, things like that? They're like, no. And they're hypertensive, their sugar's 400, and you're like, oh, you've never been tested before, so you don't know that you have those things.
Not going to the doctor for preventive care is not uncommon in parts of West Virginia, a pattern that is repeated across rural America.
If you want someone to come to the hospital, you probably got to get them here. If you're going to put them to dialysis and they can't go, you might as well not write the prescription. If you're going to give them $700 worth of antibiotics or hypertensive medicine, just realize they're going to throw it away because they can't afford it. I felt like places I had been in the world doing disaster work were better off than certain people who lived here. Certain percentage of my people don't have indoor plumbing still. Access to power in certain regions here is still not 100% available. There's a lot of places that we have ambulances go into and they show up here and they're like, I don't know if they're gonna have a medical problem, but you can't send them back to that. And you're like, to what? And they'll show you pictures of, you know, they're living in a place that is rat infested. There's raccoons inside the house. There's feces everywhere. Like, this is where they live, and this is the best they can do.
We go out and meet them where they are.
Since getting to a hospital or a clinic can be difficult for so many, Dr. Madison Humerick goes to them, delivering preventive and essential care straight out of her toolbox.
It looks like you've had ear infections in there before, huh?
Yeah.
We probably prevented a couple urgent care visits today, which
is that right?
Oh yeah, it was awesome. I mean, we got to prescribe some antibiotics, so it was convenient for them. We're just going right back to old school family medicine, which is what we love.
Just urgent care out in the open.
Urgent care out on the street, yeah.
Peer Recovery, this is Jamaica.
At times, practitioners here say the need can be overwhelming.
Hello.
Especially when it comes to mental health. Rural Americans report higher levels of depression and suffer suicide rates more than 30% higher than people who live in cities. And yet, for those people, it's harder to find help. Rural areas have fewer than half as many psychologists per capita.
It means that we have a year plus wait list in our outpatient clinic. It was recently 2 years. I think we've gotten that down to a year and a half. For adults.
Dr. Samantha Diemer is a clinical psychologist who works out of the Harpers Ferry Family Medicine Center. In atypical fashion, she embeds with this family practice to make it seamless for patients who want mental health care. But elsewhere, people face big obstacles.
It means for kids, they're waiting a year plus for specialty services like testing for ADHD or developmental disabilities. Our neuropsychologist's wait list is incredibly long. So just a lack of available services overall.
So people who could be in a crisis-like circumstance,
yeah,
would call and say, hey, can I get help? And they're told,
go to the emergency room, because that's all we can offer, yeah.
Can you start browning the chicken while I get the vegetables cut up?
Yes, I can.
Okay.
We caught back up with Nurse Angie Gray after she visited her friend Patty.
How typical is that circumstance of what we saw today?
Typical, very typical, yeah. A lot of people that I know personally, a lot of patients that we have, you know, they're all dealing with that, trying to be able to afford to get their medications, trying to get to good health care.
Hoping the power stays on.
Hoping the power stays on so that you're not out of your oxygen.
Grace says these problems are ultimately fixable, but not if we tackle them piecemeal, one patient at a time.
There's a parable in public health. You know, there's a villager walks up to the river and there's a baby floating down the river. So he pulls the baby out. Another one comes floating down the river, so he pulls the baby out. All the villagers are gathering around the river and all these babies start coming down the river and they're jumping in, pulling them out. until one villager walked upstream to see who was throwing the babies in the river. And we need to get more upstream.
Gray admits it's an uphill climb, but it's one they're taking step by step. For the PBS NewsHour, I'm William Brangham in rural West Virginia.
Supreme Court arguments often deal with weighty matters like abortion, religion, and discrimination. Today, as John Yang reports, they focused on a chew toy for dogs in a case that raises questions about free speech and commercial trademark protections.
The maker of Jack Daniel's whiskey has a bone to pick with a marketer of dog chew toys. The distiller of the iconic American liquor wants to muzzle VIP products, America's second largest dog toy company and part of the $100 billion a year pet products market. For more than 120 years, Jack Daniel's has used a distinctive square bottle adorned with Old Number 7 and Tennessee Sour Mash whiskey. Beginning in 2014, VIP began selling a squeaky dog toy called Bad Spaniels, a replica of a Jack Daniel's bottle that proclaims the Old Number 2 on your Tennessee carpet.
The hilarious dog toy that'll have everyone talking.
It's part of their Silly Squeakers line. VIP says it's a playful parody. Jack Daniel's says it could confuse consumers into thinking it's their product.
So now this dog toy tug of war has come to the Supreme Court. The question the justices are being asked to decide is, when does parody cross the line from protected free speech to commercial trademark infringement?
Free speech advocates lined up behind the dog toy company, filing amicus briefs defending parody as a recognized form of social commentary. Companies such as Nike, Patagonia, and Campbell's Soup support Jack Daniel's, saying notable trademarks need protection.
We'll hear argument this morning in case 22-148.
The justices worked through the competing interests during today's oral argument, which included references to a pornographic movie depicting the Dallas Cowboy cheerleader uniforms. The attorney for Jack Daniel's, Lisa Blatt.
The movie Debbie Does Dallas was not aesthetically pleasing. It infringed a trademark. So the other side wants to talk about the uses they like. They don't want to talk about the pornographic and poisonous things that can be done when you infringe someone's trademark.
Thank you, counsel.
Justice Samuel Alito worried about the case's First Amendment implications and seemed skeptical that Bad Spaniels could be confused as a product from Jack Daniel's.
Could any reasonable person think that Jack Daniel's had approved this use of the mark? And let me envision this scene. Somebody in Jack Daniel's comes to the CEO and says, I have a great idea for a product that we're going to produce. It's going to be a dog toy, and it's going to have a label that looks a lot like our label, and it's going to have a name that looks a lot like our name, Bad Spaniels. And what's going to be in, supportedly in this dog toy, is dog urine. You think the CEO is going to say, that's a great idea. We're going to produce that thing.
Justice Elena Kagan questioned how a dog toy could be protected speech expressing a message.
This is not a political T-shirt. It's not a film. It's not an artistic photograph. It's nothing of those things. It's a standard commercial product. I don't see the parody, but, you know, whatever.
The distinction between utilitarian goods and expressive works is a non-existent standard.
Dog toys are just utilitarian goods, and you're using somebody else's mark as a source identifier, and that's not a First Amendment problem.
NewsHour Supreme Court analyst Marcia Coyle.
This court is very strong on First Amendment speech. There are justices who are concerned about not killing parody, which is a very useful and fun part of our lives and products. So I do think that they're trying to balance the First Amendment concerns here with the actual parody and whether it does damage to Jack Daniel's trademark.
The justices will chew over the arguments as they consider their decision, which should come by the end of June. For the PBS NewsHour, I'm John Yang.
In 1889, the industrialist Andrew Carnegie, one of the richest men of his age, wrote an essay titled The Gospel of Wealth, calling on those with money to use it to promote the general good and laying a foundation for philanthropy in this country. Now comes From Generosity to Justice, a new gospel of wealth that proposes shifting the focus of giving. Its author, Darren Walker, president of the Ford Foundation, which, for the record, is a funder of the NewsHour. Jeffrey Brown spoke to Walker for our arts and culture series, Canvas.
This was the original office.
Darren Walker says the mission of the Ford Foundation is simple: hope. He's a true believer in that mission and the power of institutions like his to advance it. But he also sees a problem.
I wanted to say that while philanthropy is good and we should be proud of it, there is so much more we can do to move from the idea of generosity to the aspiration and a belief in justice for all.
Walker, now 63, became president of the $16 billion foundation in 2013. He's in the business of giving away money in this country and abroad. He's also part of a movement in recent years to shift philanthropy's focus, seen in the renaming of Ford's Manhattan headquarters to the Center for Social Justice, even in the art on its walls. We spoke recently in the foundation's atrium garden.
What does justice mean, though, in the context of philanthropy?
What we see in the world today is too many people live without dignity, are stripped of their dignity, their humanity is ignored, while we do charitable activities, which are commendable and we need. But philanthropy needs to go deeper. And part of the aspiration of this book is to lift up the voices and the experiences of those philanthropists who are doing it here in America and around the world.
Walker is now part of the power elite, but his roots go back to small town East Texas, where he was raised by a single mother who worked as a nurse's aide. He says the opportunity to attend the then new publicly funded Head Start preschool program for lower income children changed everything.
It changed my life. It put me on a trajectory where I could go to public schools, a great public university, Texas, and then be off into the world. But that was because, Jeff, I lived in a country that believed in my potential and the potential for me to have a life with dignity.
Do you still hold that past, that outsider, even though you are now a big player here in the world of philanthropy?
I do see my role as an insider, as understanding the plight of those who are outside, who are left out and left behind. And so, yes, I absolutely believe in it. But I have to say, I believe in this country. I believe in the idea of America. And when I feel angry at this country or rage for some injustice, it's because my patriotism, my belief in the words of our founding fathers is unwavering.
One of the things you write in the book is you say wealthy people should ask themselves, where are my resources most needed? Aren't they asking that question? Isn't that the question they normally ask?
The reality is that most philanthropy in this country goes to wealthy institutions that often serve the wealthy and the privileged.
From wealth to wealth, serving wealth.
Well, when you look at the percentage of philanthropy that goes to wealthy colleges and universities, to hospitals, to independent private schools, these institutions primarily serve the wealthy. Or certainly people who have more privilege. And I'm simply saying we should ask ourselves, how do we direct our philanthropy to those who are most excluded?
Is it hard to change that mindset of where the money goes?
Well, I don't mean to say that people need to have some foundational, transformational change in their thinking about philanthropy. What I mean to say is, get a little uncomfortable. When you look at organizations working on the front lines in homelessness, in building affordable housing, working on disability issues. These are areas that are heavily under-resourced in philanthropy.
And that means inevitably some who are getting it now might not get it.
I think if we are prepared to interrogate our privilege, we will conclude that philanthropy is not only about giving back, but it may be also giving up something so that we can have an America where opportunity does exist for all. And that social mobility escalator that I was able to ride continues to go up, doesn't slow down, doesn't stop as it has for far too many Americans, which is contributing to our political and civil unrest and the sense that too many Americans feel left out. Rural America, where there is not enough work going on in philanthropy, parts of our country that truly have been left behind, and where the people there feel angry, and they have every right to be angry.
You know the critiques better than anyone. Philanthropic organizations, foundations, are often built on the fortunes, right, of the very kinds of inequities that you're critiquing in our society. And they enjoy many tax breaks that many of us don't. And you yourself write, they live off and extend the privilege of wealth and power.
There's no doubt, Jeff, that there is a contradiction and a foundation having billions of dollars and an endowment and talking about inequality. But I believe we have to talk about a different kind of economic system where capitalism, which in my view is the best way to organize an economic system, produces less inequality. And so people like me, we need to ask ourselves, how do we deal with these contradictions of our privilege and our aspirations for opportunity? They are reconcilable, but we have to be intentional.
All right, from generosity to justice, Darren Walker, thank you very much.
Thank you, Jeff.
Opening day for professional baseball is just around the corner, and this year it will be notably different. Major League Baseball has enacted a series of new rules intended to make the game more exciting. Stephanie Tsai went to a spring training game in Arizona to check out the action.
On a perfect 73-degree day, baseball fans young and old flooded into Scottsdale Stadium. Spring training is Major League ball without the high stakes, explains 11-year-old Mitchell Ernest.
Yeah, it's relaxed and like they get to learn the new rules, and if they make a mistake, it doesn't matter.
The matchups, this game was between the San Francisco Giants and the Milwaukee Brewers, gives players a chance to find their groove before opening day. But this season, it's particularly critical.
You have four rules, basically.
John Shea is the national baseball writer for the San Francisco Chronicle.
You have the pitch timer, the bigger bases, the ban on shifts, and the limited pickoff attempts.
Shea explained the new rules before plays started.
The biggest rule change is the pitch clock, which is going to make the pace of the game much quicker. And the pitch timer makes sure that the pitcher will throw the ball within 20 seconds with a runner on base or within 15 seconds with nobody on base.
Gabe Kapler, the Giants manager, was initially indifferent about the new rules. Now that he's seen them in action, he's sold.
It's been a lot quicker pace, and we've gotten the same good brand of baseball.
The average length of games during the first weekend of spring training was down 23 minutes. But not everyone's a fan.
What do you think about the pitch clock?
I kind of think it's kind of stupid, but...
Why do you think it's stupid?
Because it's an automatic ball if they don't throw it in 20 seconds.
10-year-old Rhodes Powelson likes to take his time when he pitches. For Giants pitcher Sam Long, who usually works fast on the mound, the rules ain't so bad, at least now that he understands them.
I got my first violation in my first inning of spring training, and that before I even threw a pitch.
How did that feel?
Felt like I was at a little bit of a disadvantage to start.
And a week into spring training, New York Mets pitcher Max Scherzer tried to push the boundaries of the new rules to his advantage. But he was called for a balk because he pitched too soon after the pitch clock had reset. The other major adjustment? The bases are bigger now, 18 inches across instead of 15.
The new distance between home plate and first base is 3 inches shorter. It's a change that favors runners and could lead to more aggressive stolen base attempts.
Giants manager Kapler says he's already seeing it pay off.
We are seeing more stolen base attempts so far in spring training. Fans want to see more action. The stolen base is an exciting part of baseball, so the rules are being set up so that you see a little bit more of that.
Giants fan Chris Soroff, who watches more than 70 baseball games a year, says the bigger bases are an offense to history.
I think you have to throw out all of the stolen base records and some of the hits that are going to be achieved now. And Ricky Henderson, the all-time steal leader, you know, I'm sure that he's not too happy about it.
But Giants first baseman Lamont Wade Jr. sees the perks.
The runner has more room on the base to step on the bag instead of not really stepping on your ankles or on your feet. So I like the bigger bases for that aspect.
The last big change involves how players stand on the field. Long gone are the days of the infamous shift, where players crowd onto one side to anticipate the direction a power hitter will direct the ball. The new rules force two players to stand on each side of second base, with all their feet on the infield dirt when a pitch is thrown. That means more hits and more action on the field, running, fielding, and the like.
It takes a little game strategy out of the mix for managers and coaches and puts the onus on the players to be more athletic, because we're just not going to have that perfectly optimized defensive positioning anymore. And, you know, athletes are just going to have to cover a little bit more ground.
Brewers fan Gary Ray was taking in the game without much thought to the new rules, although he says it was about time.
With all the other, I would say, major leagues out there, you have NFL, NBA, NHL even, the emphasis on making sure there's more excitement to the game. So I think MLB was kind of long overdue to make some changes.
It's the game folks in the 60s and 70s grew up watching, when pitchers couldn't stall for eternity. There were more stolen bases and players took risks, says John Shea.
It's a quicker pace, and that's kind of the game I wanted all along.
Opening day in a new era for Major League Baseball is March 30th. For the PBS NewsHour, I'm Stephanie Tsai in Scottsdale, Arizona.
I don't know. What do you think?
There's nothing wrong with a four-hour baseball game. I'm a purist. I like the old rules.
I don't know. I thought we'd see Stephanie Tsai sliding into base during that story next time. In the meantime, that is the NewsHour for tonight. Hey, join us again here tomorrow when the head of TikTok is set to testify before Congress in the wake of growing calls to ban the app. I'm Amna Nawaz.
And I'm Jeff Bennett. Thanks for spending part of your evening with us. Have a good night.